rebellious about saying his prayers every day. He tried to teach Warlock how to make rabble-rousing political speeches to sway the hearts and minds of multitudes. Mr. Cortez taught him about Florence Nightingale. Footnote, except for the bits about syphilis. Abraham Lincoln, and the appreciation of art. He tried to teach him about free will, self-denial, and doing unto others as you would wish them to do to you. They both read to the child extensively from the Book of Revelation. Despite their best efforts, Warlock showed a regrettable tendency to be good at maths. Neither of his tutors was entirely satisfied with his progress. When Warlock was 10, he liked baseball. He liked plastic toys that transformed into other plastic toys, indistinguishable from the first set of plastic toys, except to the trained eye. He liked his stamp collection. He liked banana-flavor bubblegum. He liked comics and cartoons, and his BMX bike. Crowley was troubled. They were in the cafeteria of the British Museum, another refuge for all weary foot soldiers of the Cold War. At the table to their left, two ramrod-straight Americans in suits were surreptitiously handing over a briefcase full of deniable dollars to a small dark woman in sunglasses. At the table on their right, the deputy head of MI7 and the local KGB section officer argued over who got to keep the receipt for the tea and buns. Crowley finally said what he had not even dared to think for the last decade. "If you ask me," Crowley said to his counterpart, "he's too bloody normal." Aziraphale popped another deviled egg into his mouth and washed it down with coffee. He dabbed his lips with a paper napkin. "It's my good influence," he beamed. "Or rather, credit where credit's due, that of my little team." Crowley shook his head. "I'm taking that into account. Look, by now he should be trying to warp the world around him to his own desires, shaping it in his own image, that kind of stuff. Well, not actually trying. He'll do it without even knowing it. Have you seen any evidence of that happening?" "Well, no. But by now he should be a powerhouse of raw force. Is he?" "Well, not as far as I've noticed, but he's too normal." Crowley drummed his fingers on the table. "I don't like it. There's something wrong. I just can't put my finger on it." Aziraphale helped himself to Crowley's slice of angel cake. "Well, he's a growing boy. And, of course, there's been the heavenly influence in his life." Crowley sighed. "I just hope he'll know how to cope with the hellhound, that's all." Aziraphale raised one eyebrow. "Hellhound?" "On his 11th birthday. I received a message from Hell last night." The message had come during The Golden Girls, one of Crowley's favourite television programmes. Rose had taken 10 minutes to deliver what could have been quite a brief communication, and by the time non-infernal service was restored, Crowley had quite lost the thread of the plot. "They're sending him a hellhound to pad by his side and guard him from all harm. Biggest one they've got." "Won't people remark on the sudden appearance of a huge black dog?" "His parents, for a start." Crowley stood up suddenly, treading on the foot of a Bulgarian cultural attaché who was talking animatedly to the keeper of Her Majesty's antiques. "Nobody's gonna notice anything out of the ordinary. It's reality, Angel. And young Warlock can do what he wants to that, whether he knows it or not. When does it turn up, then, this dog? Does it have a name?" "I told you, on his 11th birthday, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It'll sort of home in on him. He's supposed to name it himself. It's very important that he names it himself. It gives it its purpose. It'll be Killer or Terror or Stalks by Night, I expect." "Are you going to be there?" asked the angel, nonchalantly. "Wouldn't miss it for the worlds," said Crowley. "I do hope there's nothing too wrong with the child. We'll see how he reacts to the dog, anyway. That should tell us something. I hope he'll send it back or be frightened of it. If he does name it, we've lost. He'll have all his powers, and Armageddon is just around the corner." I think, said Aziraphale, sipping his wine, which had just ceased to be a slightly vinegary Beaujolais and had become a quite acceptable but rather surprised Chateau Lafitte, 1875. I think I'll see you there. Wednesday. It was a hot, fume-filled August day in central London. Warlock's 11th birthday was very well attended. There were 20 small boys and 17 small girls. There were a lot of men with identical blonde crew cuts, dark blue suits, and shoulder holsters. There was a crew of caterers who had arrived bearing jellies, cakes, and bowls of crisps. Their procession of vans was led by a vintage Bentley. The amazing Harvey and Wanda, children's parties a speciality, had both been struck down by an unexpected tummy bug. But by a providential turn of fortune, a replacement had turned up, practically out of the blue. A stage magician. Everyone has his little hobby. Despite Crowley's urgent advice, Aziraphale was intending to turn his to good use. Aziraphale was particularly proud of his magical skills. He had attended a class in the 1870s run by John Maskelyne and had spent almost a year practising sleight of hand, palming coins and taking rabbits out of hats. He had got, he had felt at the time, quite good at it. The point was that although Aziraphale was capable of doing things that could make the entire magic circle hand in their wands, he never applied what might be called his intrinsic powers to the practice of sleight-of-hand conjuring, which was a major drawback. He was beginning to wish that he'd continued practicing. Still, he mused, it was like riding a velocipede. You never forgot how. His magician's coat had been a little dusty, but it felt good once it was on. Even his old patter began to come back to him. The children watched him in blank, disdainful incomprehension. Behind the buffet, Crowley, in his white waiter's coat, cringed with contact embarrassment. "Now then, young masters and mistresses, do you see my battered old top hat? What a shocking bad hat, as you young'uns do say. And see, there's nothing in it. But bless my britches, who's this rum customer? Why, it's our furry friend, Harry the Rabbit." "It was in your pocket," pointed out Warlock. The other children nodded agreement. What did he think they were, kids? Aziraphale remembered what Maskelyne had told him about dealing with hecklers. "Make a joke of it, you pudding heads, and I do mean you, Mr. Fell," the name Aziraphale had adopted at that time. "Make 'em laugh, and they'll forgive you anything." "Ho, so you've rumbled my hat trick," he chuckled. The children stared at him impassively. "You're rubbish," said Warlock. "I wanted cartoons anyway." "He's right, you know," agreed a small girl with a ponytail. "You are rubbish, and probably a faggot." Aziraphale stared desperately at Crowley. As far as he was concerned, young Warlock was obviously infernally tainted, and the sooner the black dog turned up and they could get away from this place, the better. "Now, do any of you young'uns have such a thing as a thrapenny bit about your persons? No, young master? Then what's this I see behind your ear?" "I got cartoons at my birthday," announced the little girl. "And I got a Transformer, and a My Little Pony, and a Decepticon Attacker, and a Thunder Tank, and a..." Crowley groaned. Children's parties were obviously places where any angel with an ounce of common sense should fear to tread. Piping infant voices were raised in cynical merriment as Aziraphale dropped three linked metal rings. Crowley looked away, and his gaze fell on a table heaped high with presents. From a tall plastic structure, two beady little eyes stared back at him. Crowley scrutinized them for a glint of red fire. You could never be certain when you were dealing with the bureaucrats of hell. It was always possible that they had sent a gerbil instead of a dog. No, it was a perfectly normal gerbil. It appeared to be living in an exciting construction of cylinders, spheres, and treadmills, such as the Spanish Inquisition would have devised if they'd had access to a plastics moulding press. He checked his watch. It had never occurred to Crowley to change its battery, which had rotted away 3 years previously, but it still kept perfect time. It was 2:58. Aziraphale was getting more and more flustered. "Do any of the company here assembled possess such a thing about their persons as a pocket handkerchief? No?" In Victorian days, it had been unheard of for people not to carry handkerchiefs. And the trick, which involved magically producing a dove, who was even now pecking irritably at Aziraphale's wrist, could not proceed without one. The angel tried to attract Crowley's attention, failed, and in desperation pointed to one of the security guards, who shifted uneasily. "You, my fine jacksauce, come here. Now, if you inspect your breast pocket, I think you might find a fine silk handkerchief."
"No, sir. I'm afraid not, sir," said the guard, staring straight ahead.
Aziraphale winked desperately.
"No, go on, dear boy. Take a look, please."
The guard reached a hand inside his inside pocket, looked surprised, and pulled out a handkerchief, dark egg blue silk with lace edging. Aziraphale realized almost immediately that the lace had been a mistake, as it caught on the guard's holstered gun and sent it spinning across the room to land heavily in a bowl of jelly. The children applauded spasmodically.
"Hey, not bad," said the ponytail girl.
Warlock had already run across the room and grabbed the gun.
"Hands up, dog breaths," he shouted gleefully.
The security guards were in a quandary. Some of them fumbled for their own weapons. Others started edging their way toward or away from the boy. The other children started complaining that they wanted guns as well, and a few of the more forward ones started trying to tug them from the guards who had been thoughtless enough to take their weapons out. Then someone threw some jelly at Warlock. The boy squeaked and pulled the trigger of the gun. It was a Magnum 32 CIA issue, grey, mean, heavy, capable of blowing a man away at 30 paces and leaving nothing more than a red mist, a ghastly mess, and a certain amount of paperwork. Aziraphale blinked. A thin stream of water squirted from the nozzle and soaked Crowley, who had been looking out the window trying to see if there was a huge black dog in the garden. Aziraphale looked embarrassed. Then a cream cake hit him in the face. It was almost 3:05. With a gesture, Aziraphale turned the rest of the guns into water pistols as well and walked out. Crowley found him on the pavement outside trying to extricate a rather squishy dove from the arm of his frock coat. "It's late," said Aziraphale.
"Well, I can see that," said Crowley. "Comes of sticking it up your sleeve."
He reached out and pulled the limp bird from Aziraphale's coat and breathed life back into it. The dove cooed appreciatively and flew off a trifle warily.
"Not the bird," said the angel. "The dog. It's late."
Crowley shook his head thoughtfully.
"We'll see."
He opened the car door, flipped on the radio.
"I should be so lucky. Lucky, 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 lucky. I should be so lucky in..."
"Hello, Crowley."
Hello. Who is this?"
"Dagon, Lord of the Files, Master of Madness, Underduke of the Seventh Torment. What can I do for you?"
Well, the Hellhound, I'm just, checking that it got off okay."
"Released 10 minutes ago. Why? Hasn't it arrived? Is something wrong?"
"Oh, no, nothing's wrong. Everything's fine."
"Oops, yeah, I can see it now. Good dog, nice dog. Yeah, everything's terrific. You're doing a great job down there, people. Well, lovely talking to you, Dagon. Catch you soon, huh?"
He flipped off the radio. They stared at each other. There was a loud bang from inside the house, and a window shattered.
"Oh, dear," muttered Aziraphale, not swearing with the practiced ease of one who has spent 6,000 years not swearing, and who wasn't going to start now. I must have missed one.
No dog, said Crowley.
No dog, said Aziraphale.
The demon sighed.
Get in the car, he said. We've got to talk about this.
Oh, and Aziraphale?
Yes?
Clean off that blasted cream cake before you get in.
It was a hot, silent August day, far from central London. By the side of the Tadfield Road, the dust weighed down the hogweed. Bees buzzed in the hedges. The air had a leftover and reheated feel. There was a sound like a thousand metal voices shouting, "Hail!" cut off abruptly. And there was a black dog in the road. It had to be a dog. It was dog-shaped. There are some dogs which, when you meet them, remind you that despite thousands of years of man-made evolution, every dog is still only 2 meals away from being a wolf. These dogs advance deliberately, purposefully. The wilderness made flesh, their teeth yellow, their breath a stink. While, in the distance, their owners twitter, "He's an old soppy, really. Just poke him if he's a nuisance." And in the green of their eyes, the red campfires of the Pleistocene gleam and flicker. This dog would make even a dog like that slink nonchalantly behind the sofa and pretend to be extremely preoccupied with its rubber bone. It was already growling, and the growl was a low, rumbling snarl of spring-coiled menace, the sort of growl that starts in the back of one throat and ends up in someone else's. Saliva dripped from its jaws and sizzled on the tar. It took a few steps forward and sniffed the sullen air. Its ears flicked up. There were voices a long way off. A voice. A boyish voice, but one it had been created to obey, could not help but obey. When that voice said follow, it would follow. When it said kill, it would kill. His master's voice. It leapt the hedge and padded across the field beyond. A grazing bull eyed it for a moment, weighed its chances, then strolled hurriedly towards the opposite hedge. The voices were coming from a copse of straggly trees. The black hound slunk closer, jaws streaming. One of the other voices said,
"He never will. You're always saying he will, and he never does. Catch your dad giving you a pet, an interesting pet, anyway. It'll probably be stick insects. That's your dad's idea of interesting."
The hound gave the canine equivalent of a shrug, but immediately lost interest because now the master, the center of its universe, spoke. "It'll be a dog," it said.
"Ha! You don't know it's going to be a dog. No one said it's going to be a dog. How do you know it's going to be a dog if no one said? Your dad'd be complaining about the food it eats the whole time. Privet."
This third voice was rather more prim than the first two. The owner of a voice like that would be the sort of person who, before making a plastic model kit, would not only separate and count all the parts before commencing, as per instructions, but also paint the bits that needed painting first and leave them to dry properly prior to construction. All that separated this voice from chartered accountancy was a matter of time.
"They don't eat privet, Wensley. You never saw a dog eating privet. Stick insects do, I mean. They're jolly interesting, actually. They eat each other when they're mating."
There was a thoughtful pause. The hound slunk closer and realized that the voices were coming from a hole in the ground. The trees, in fact, concealed an ancient chalk quarry, now half overgrown with thorn trees and vines. Ancient, but clearly not disused. Tracks crisscrossed it. Smooth areas of slope indicated regular use by skateboards and wall of death, or at least wall of seriously grazed knee, cyclists. Old bits of dangerously frayed rope hung from some of the more accessible greenery. Here and there, sheets of corrugated iron and old wooden boards were wedged in branches. A burnt-out, rusting Triumph Herald estate was visible, half-submerged in a drift of nettles. In one corner, a tangle of wheels and corroded wire marked the site of the famous Lost Graveyard, where the supermarket trolleys came to die. If you were a child, it was paradise. The local adults called it the pit. The hound peered through a clump of nettles and spotted four figures sitting in the centre of the quarry on that indispensable prop to good secret dens everywhere, the common milk crate.
"They don't."
"They do."
"Bet you they don't," said the first speaker.
It had a certain timbre to it that identified it as young and female, and it was tinted with horrified fascination.
"They do, actually. I had six before we went on holiday, and I forgot to change the privet, and when I came back, I had one big fat one."
"Nah, that's not stick insects. That's praying mantises. I saw on the television where this big female one ate this other one, and it didn't hardly take any notice."
There was another crowded pause. "What are they praying about?" said his master's voice.
"Dunno. Praying they don't have to get married, I expect."
The hound managed to get one huge eye against an empty knothole in the quarry's broken-down fence and squinted downward.
"Anyway, it's like with bikes,"
said the first speaker authoritatively.
"I thought I was going to get this bike with seven gears and one of them razor-blade saddles and purple paint and everything, and they gave me this light blue one with a basket, a girl's bike."
"Well, you're a girl," said one of the others.
"That's sexism, that is, going around giving people girly presents just because they're a girl."
"I'm going to get a dog," said his master's voice firmly.
His master had his back to him. The hound couldn't quite make out his features.
"Oh, yeah, one of those great big Rottenweilers, yeah?"
said the girl with withering sarcasm.
"No, it's going to be the kind of dog you can have fun with," said his master's voice. "Not a big dog."
The eye in the nettles vanished abruptly downwards.
"But one of those dogs that's brilliantly intelligent and can go down rabbit holes and has one funny ear that always looks inside out. And a proper mongrel, too. A pedigree mongrel."
Unheard by those within, there was a tiny clap of thunder on the lip of the quarry. It might have been caused by the sudden rushing of air into the vacuum caused by a very large dog becoming, for example, a small dog. The tiny popping noise that followed might have been caused by one ear turning itself inside out.
"And I'll call him," said his master's voice. "I'll call him..."
"Yes," said the girl. "What's you going to call it?"
The hound waited. This was the moment. The naming. This would give it its purpose, its function, its identity. Its eyes glowed a dull red, even though they were a lot closer to the ground, and it dribbled into the nettles.
"I'll call him Dog," said his master, positively. "It saves a lot of trouble, a name like that."
The hellhound paused. Deep in its diabolical canine brain, it knew that something was wrong. But it was nothing if not obedient, and its great sudden love of its master overcame all misgivings.
Who was it to say what size it should be, anyway?
It trotted down the slope to meet its destiny. Strange, though. It had always wanted to jump up at people, but now it realized that, against all expectation, it wanted to wag its tail at the same time.
"You said it was him,"
moaned Aziraphale, abstractedly picking the final lump of cream cake from his lapel. He licked his fingers clean.
"It was him," said Crowley. "I mean, I should know, shouldn't I?"
"Then someone else must be interfering."
"There isn't anyone else. There's just us, right?
Good and evil. One side or the other." He thumped the steering wheel.
"You'll be amazed at the kind of things they can do to you down there," he said.
"I imagine they're very similar to the sort of things they can do to one up there," said Aziraphale.
"Ah, come off it. Your lot get ineffable mercy," said Crowley sourly.
"Yes. Did you ever visit Gomorrah?"
"Sure," said the demon.
There was this great little tavern where you could get these terrific fermented date palm cocktails with nutmeg and crushed lemongrass. I meant afterwards.
Oh.
Aziraphale said, something must have happened in the hospital.
Well, it couldn't have. It was full of our people.
Whose people? Said Aziraphale coldly.
Well, my people, corrected Crowley.
Well, not my people. You know, Satanists.
He tried to say it dismissively.
Apart from, of course, the fact that the world was an amazing, interesting place which they both wanted to enjoy for as long as possible, there were few things that the two of them agreed on. But they did see eye to eye about some of those people who, for one reason or another, were inclined to worship the Prince of Darkness. Crowley always found them embarrassing. You couldn't actually be rude to them.
But you couldn't help feeling about them the same way that, say, a Vietnam veteran would feel about someone who wears combat gear to neighborhood watch meetings. Besides, they were always so depressingly enthusiastic. Take all that stuff with the inverted crosses and pentagrams and cockerels. It mystified most demons. It wasn't the least bit necessary. All you needed to become a Satanist was an effort of will. You could be one all your life without ever knowing what a pentagram was, without ever seeing a dead cockerel, other than as chicken merengo. Besides, some of the old-style Satanists tended, in fact, to be quite nice people. They mouthed the words and went through the motions, just like the people they thought of as their opposite numbers, and then went home and lived lives of mild, unassuming mediocrity for the rest of the week, with never an unusually evil thought in their heads. And as for the rest of it, there were people who called themselves Satanists who did make Crowley squirm. It wasn't just the things they did, it was the way they blamed it all on hell. They'd come up with some stomach-churning idea that no demon could have thought of in 1,000 years. Some dark and mindless unpleasantness that only a fully functioning human brain could conceive. Then shout, "The devil made me do it!" and get the sympathy of the court, when the whole point was that the devil hardly ever made anyone do anything. He didn't have to. That was what some humans found hard to understand. Hell wasn't a major reservoir of evil, any more than heaven, in Crowley's opinion, was a fountain of goodness. They were just sides in the great cosmic chess game. Where you found the real McCoy, the real Grace, and the real heart-stopping evil was right inside the human mind. Said Aziraphale. Satanists. I don't see how they could have messed it up, said Crowley. I mean, two babies. It's not exactly taxing, is it? He stopped. Through the mists of memory, he pictured a small nun who had struck him at the time as being remarkably loose-headed, even for a Satanist. And there had been someone else. Crowley vaguely recalled a pipe and a cardigan with the kind of zigzag pattern that went out of style in 1938, a man with expectant father written all over him. There must have been a third baby. He told Aziraphale.
Not a lot to go on, said the angel.
We know the child must be alive, said Crowley. So, how do we know? Well, if it had turned up down there again, do you think I'd still be sitting here?
Good point.
So, all we've got to do is find it, said Crowley. Go through the hospital records.
The Bentley's engine coughed into life and the car leapt forward, forcing Aziraphale back into the seat.
And then what? He said.
And then we find the child.
And then what?
The angel shut his eyes as the car crabbed around a corner.
Don't know.
Good grief. Well, I suppose get off the road, you clown. Your people wouldn't consider... And the scooter you rode in on.
Giving me asylum.
I was going to ask you the same thing. Watch out for that pedestrian.
It's on the street. It knows the risks it's taking.
Said Crowley, easing the accelerating car between a parked car and a taxi, and leaving a space which would have barely accepted even the best credit card.
Watch the road, watch the road! Where is this hospital, anyway?
Somewhere south of Oxford.
Aziraphale grabbed the dashboard.
You can't do 90 miles an hour in central London.
Crowley peered at the dial.
Why not? He said. You'll get us killed.
Aziraphale hesitated.
Inconveniently discorporated, he corrected lamely, relaxing a little. Anyway, you might kill other people.
Crowley shrugged.
The angel had never really come to grips with the 20th century and didn't realize that it's perfectly possible to do 90 miles an hour down Oxford Street. You just arranged matters so that no one was in the way. And since everyone knew that it was impossible to do 90 miles an hour down Oxford Street, no one noticed. At least cars were better than horses. The internal combustion engine had been a windfall for Crowley. The only horses he could be seen riding, on business, in the old days, were big black jobs with eyes like flame and hooves that struck sparks. That was de rigueur for a demon. Usually Crowley fell off. He wasn't much good with animals. Somewhere around Chiswick, Aziraphale scrabbled vaguely in the scree of tapes in the glove compartment.
"What's a velvet underground?" he said.
"You wouldn't like it," said Crowley.
"Oh," said the angel, dismissively, "bebop."
"Do you know, Aziraphale, that probably if a million human beings were asked to describe modern music, they wouldn't use the term bebop," said Crowley.
"Ah, yeah, this is more like it."
Tchaikovsky, said Aziraphale, opening a case and slotting its cassette into the Blaupunkt.
You won't enjoy it, sighed Crowley. It's been in the car for more than a fortnight.
A heavy bass beat began to thump through the Bentley as they sped past Heathrow. Aziraphale's brow furrowed.
I don't recognize this, he said. What is it?
It's Tchaikovsky's Another One Bites the Dust, said Crowley, closing his eyes as they went through Slough.
To while away the time, as they crossed the sleeping Chilterns, they also listened to William Byrd's We Are the Champions and Beethoven's I Want to Break Free. Neither were as good as Vaughan Williams's Fat-Bottomed Girls. It is said that the devil has all the best tunes. This is broadly true, but heaven has the best choreographers. The Oxfordshire plain stretched out to the west, with a scattering of lights to mark the slumbering villages where honest yeomen were settling down to sleep, after a long day's editorial direction, financial consulting, or software engineering. Up here on the hill, a few glowworms were lighting up. The surveyor's theodolite is one of the more direful symbols of the 20th century. Set up anywhere in open countryside, it says, there will come road widening, yea, and 2,000 home estates in keeping with the essential character of the village. Executive developments will be manifest. But not even the most conscientious surveyor surveys at midnight. And yet here the thing was, tripod legs deep in the turf. Not many theodolites have a hazel twig strapped to the top either, or crystal pendulums hanging from them and the Celtic runes carved into the legs. The soft breeze flapped the cloak of the slim figure who was adjusting the knobs of the thing. It was quite a heavy cloak, sensibly waterproof, with a warm lining. Most books on witchcraft will tell you that witches work naked. This is because most books on witchcraft are written by men. The young woman's name was Anathema Device. She was not astonishingly beautiful. All her features, considered individually, were extremely pretty. But the entirety of her face gave the impression that it had been put together hurriedly from stock, without reference to any plan. Probably the most suitable word is attractive, although people who knew what it meant and could spell it might add vivacious, although there is something very 50s about vivacious, so perhaps they wouldn't. Young women should not go alone on dark nights, even in Oxfordshire. But any prowling maniac would have had more than his work cut out if he had accosted Anathema Device. She was a witch, after all, and precisely because she was a witch, and therefore sensible, she put little faith in protective amulets and spells. She saved it all for a foot-long bread knife, which she kept in her belt. She sighted through the glass and made another adjustment. She muttered under her breath. Surveyors often mutter under their breath. They mutter things like, "Soon have a relief road through here faster than you can say Jack Robinson." Or, "That's 3.5 metres, give or take a gnat's whisker." This was an entirely different kind of muttering. "Darksome night and shining moon," muttered Anathema. "East by south, by west by southwest, west-southwest." "Got you." She picked up a folded ordnance survey map and held it in the torchlight. Then she produced a transparent ruler and a pencil and carefully drew a line across the map. It intersected another pencil line. She smiled, not because anything was particularly amusing, but because a tricky job had been done well. Then she collapsed the strange theodolite, strapped it onto the back of a sit-up-and-beg black bicycle leaning against the hedge, made sure the book was in the basket, and wheeled everything out to the misty lane. It was a very ancient bike, with a frame apparently made of drain pipes. It had been built long before the invention of the three-speed gear, and possibly only just after the invention of the wheel. But it was nearly all downhill to the village. Hair streaming in the wind, cloak ballooning behind her like a sheet anchor, she let the two-wheeled juggernaut accelerate ponderously through the warm air. At least there wasn't any traffic at this time of night. The Bentley's engine went pink, pink as it cooled. Crowley's temper, on the other hand, was heating up. "You said you saw it signposted," he said. "Well, we flashed by so quickly. Anyway, I thought you'd been here before."
11 years ago.
Crowley hurled the map onto the back seat and started the engine again.
"Perhaps we should ask someone," said Aziravale.
"Oh, yes," said Crowley. "We'll stop and ask the first person we see walking along a track in the middle of the night, shall we?"
He jerked the car into gear and roared out into the beech-hung lane.
"There's something odd about this area," said Aziraphale. "Can't you feel it?"
"What?"
"Slow down a moment."
The Bentley slowed again.
"Odd," muttered the angel. "I keep getting these flashes of...
He raised his hands to his temples.
"What? What?" said Crowley.
Aziraphale stared at him.
"Love," he said. "Someone really loves this place."
"Pardon?"
"There seems to be this great sense of love. I can't put it any better than that. Especially not to you."
"Do you mean like..." Crowley began. There was a whir, a scream, and a clunk.
The car stopped. Aziraphale blinked, lowered his hands, and gingerly opened the door.
"You've hit someone," he said.
"No, I haven't," said Crowley. "Someone's hit me."
They got out. Behind the Bentley, a bicycle lay in the road, its front wheel bent into a creditable Mobius shape, its back wheel clicking ominously to a standstill.
"Let there be light," said Aziraphale.
A pale blue glow filled the lane. From the ditch beside them, someone said,
"How the hell did you do that?"
The light vanished.
Do what?
Said Aziraphale guiltily. Now the voice sounded muzzy.
I think I hit my head on something.
Crowley glared at the long metallic streak on the Bentley's glossy paintwork and a dimple in the bumper. The dimple popped back into shape. The paint healed.
"Up you get, young lady,"
said the angel, hauling Anathema out of the bracken.
"No bones broken."
It was a statement, not a hope. There had been a minor fracture, but Aziraphale couldn't resist an opportunity to do good.
"You didn't have any lights," she began.
"Nor did you," said Crowley, guiltily. "Fair's fair."
"Doing a spot of astronomy, weren't we?"
said Aziraphale, setting the bike upright. Various things clattered out of its front basket. He pointed to the battered theodolite.
No, said Anathema. I mean, yes. And look what you've done to poor old Phaeton.
I'm sorry, said Aziraphale.
My bicycle. It's bent all to...
Amazingly resilient, these old machines, said the angel brightly, handing it to her.
The front wheel gleamed in the moonlight, as perfectly round as one of the circles of hell. She stared at it.
Well, since that's all sorted out, said Crowley, perhaps it'd be best if we just all got on our,
you wouldn't happen to know the way to Lower Tadfield, would you?
Anathema was still staring at her bicycle. She was almost certain that it hadn't had a little saddlebag with a puncture repair kit when she set out.
It's just down the hill, she said. This is my bike, isn't it?
Oh, certainly, said Aziraphale, wondering if he'd overdone things.
Only I'm sure Phaeton never had a pump.
The angel looked guilty again.
But there's a place for one, he said helplessly. Two little hooks.
Just down the hill, you said, said Crowley, nudging the angel.
I think perhaps I must have knocked my head, said the girl.
We'd offer to give you a lift, of course, said Crowley quickly, but there's nowhere for the bike.
Except the luggage rack, said Aziraphale.
Well, the Bentley hasn't...
Oh.
The angel scrambled the spilled contents of the bike's basket into the back seat and helped the stunned girl in after them.
One does not, he said to Crowley, pass by on the other side.
Your one might not, this one does. We have got other things to do, you know.
Crowley glared at the new luggage rack. It had tartan straps. The bicycle lifted itself up and tied itself firmly in place. Then Crowley got in.
Where do you live, my dear?
Aziraphale oozed.
My bike didn't have lights either. Well, it did, but they're the sort you put those double batteries in, and they went mouldy and I took them off, said Anathema.
She glared at Crowley.
I have a bread knife, you know, she said. Somewhere.
Aziraphale looked shocked at the implication.
Madam, I assure you...
Crowley switched on the lights.
He didn't need them to see by, but they made the other humans on the road less nervous.
Then he put the car into gear and drove sedately down the hill. The road came out from under the trees and after a few hundred yards reached the outskirts of a middle-sized village. It had a familiar feel to it. It had been 11 years, but this place definitely rang a distant bell.
Is there a hospital around here? He said. Run by nuns?
Anathema shrugged.
Don't think so, she said. The only large place is Tadfield Manor. I don't know what goes on there.
Divine planning, muttered Crowley under his breath.
And gears, said Anathema. My bike didn't have gears. I'm sure my bike didn't have gears.
Crowley leaned across to the angel. Oh, Lord, heal this bike, he whispered sarcastically.
I'm sorry, I just got carried away, hissed Aziraphale.
Tartan straps.
Tartan is stylish.
Crowley growled. On those occasions when the angel managed to get his mind into the 20th century, it always gravitated to 1950.
You can drop me off here, said Anathema from the back seat.
Our pleasure, beamed the angel.
As soon as the car had stopped, he had the back door open and was bowing like an aged retainer welcoming the young Massa back to the old plantation. Anathema gathered her things together and stepped out as haughtily as possible. She was quite sure neither of the two men had gone around to the back of the car, but the bike was unstrapped and leaning against the gate. There was definitely something very weird about them, she decided. Aziraphale bowed again.
So glad to have been of assistance, he said.
Thank you, said Anathema, icily. Can we get on? Said Crowley.
Good night, miss. Get in, angel.
Ah, well,
that explained it. She had been perfectly safe, after all. She watched the car disappear toward the centre of the village and wheeled the bike up the path to the cottage. She hadn't bothered to lock it.
She was sure that Agnes would have mentioned it if she was going to be burgled. She was always very good at personal things like that. She'd rented the cottage furnished, which meant that the actual furniture was the special sort you find in these circumstances, and had probably been left out for the dustman by the local War on Want shop. It didn't matter. She didn't expect to be here long. If Agnes was right, she wouldn't be anywhere long, nor would anyone else. She spread her maps and things out on the ancient table under the kitchen's solitary light bulb. What had she learned? Nothing much, she decided. Probably it was at the north end of the village, but she'd suspected that anyway. If you got too close, the signal swamped you. If you were too far away, you couldn't get an accurate fix. It was infuriating. The answer must be in the book somewhere. The trouble was that in order to understand the predictions, you had to be able to think like a half-crazed, highly intelligent 17th-century witch with a mind like a crossword puzzle dictionary. Other members of the family had said that Agnes made things obscure to conceal them from the understanding of outsiders. Anathema, who suspected she could occasionally think like Agnes, had privately decided that it was because Agnes was a bloody-minded old bitch with a mean sense of humour. She didn't have the book. Anathema stared in horror at the things on the table. The maps, the homemade divinatory theodolite, the thermos that had contained hot bovril, the torch. The rectangle of empty air where the prophecies should have been. She'd lost it. But that was ridiculous. One of the things Agnes was always very specific about was what happened to the book. She snatched up the torch and ran from the house. A feeling like the opposite of the feeling you're having when you say things like, "This feels spooky," said Aziraphale. "That's what I mean."
"I never say things like, 'This feels spooky,'" said Crowley. "I'm all for spooky."
"A cherished feel," said Aziraphale desperately.
"Nope, can't sense a thing," said Crowley with forced jolliness. "You're just oversensitive."
"It's my job," said Aziraphale. "Angels can't be oversensitive. I expect people round here like living here, and you're just picking it up." "Never picked up anything like this in London," said Aziraphale.
"Well, there you are then, proves my point," said Crowley.
"And this is the place. I remember the stone lions on the gateposts."
The Bentley's headlights lit up the groves of overgrown rhododendrons that lined the drive. The tyres crunched over gravel.
"It's a bit early in the morning to be calling on nuns," said Aziraphale doubtfully.
"Nonsense, nuns are up and about at all hours," said Crowley.
"It's probably compline,
unless that's a slimming aid."
"Oh, cheap, very cheap," said the angel. "There's really no need for that sort of thing. Oh, don't get defensive. I told you these were some of ours, black nuns. We needed a hospital close to the airbase, you see." "You've lost me there."
"You don't think American diplomats' wives usually give birth in little religious hospitals in the middle of nowhere, do you?
It all had to seem to happen naturally. There's an airbase at Lower Tadfield. She went there for the opening. Things started to happen. Base hospital not ready. Our man there said, 'There's a place just down the road.' And there we were. Rather good organisation."
"Except for one or two minor details," said Aziraphale smugly.
"But it nearly worked," snapped Crowley, feeling he should stick up for the old firm. "You see, evil always contains the seeds of its own destruction," said the angel. "It is ultimately negative, and therefore encompasses its downfall, even at its moments of apparent triumph. No matter how grandiose, how well-planned, how apparently foolproof an evil plan, the inherent sinfulness will, by definition, rebound upon its instigators. No matter how apparently successful it may seem upon the way, at the end it will wreck itself. It will founder upon the rocks of iniquity and sink headfirst to vanish without trace into the seas of oblivion."
Crowley considered this.
"Nah," he said at last. "For my money, it was just average incompetence."
"Hey,"
he whistled under his breath. The gravelled forecourt in front of the manor was crowded with cars, and they weren't non-cars. The Bentley was, if anything, outclassed. A lot of the cars had GT or Turbo in their names and phone aerials on their roofs. They were nearly all less than a year old. Crowley's hands itched. Aziraphale-heeled bicycles and broken bones, he longed to steal a few radios, let down some tyres, that sort of thing. He resisted it. "Well, well," he said. "In my day, nuns were packed four to a Morris Traveller." "This can't be right," said Aziraphale. "Or perhaps they've gone private," said Crowley. "Or you've got the wrong place." "It's the right place, I tell you. Come on." They got out of the car. 30 seconds later, someone shot both of them with incredible accuracy. If there was one thing that Mary Hodges, formerly loquacious, was good at, it was attempting to obey orders. She liked orders. They made the world a simpler place. What she wasn't good at was change. She'd really liked the chattering order. She'd made friends for the first time. She'd had a room of her own for the first time. Of course, she knew that it was engaged in things which might, from certain viewpoints, be considered bad. But Mary Hodges had seen quite a lot of life in 30 years, and had no illusions about what most of the human race had to do in order to make it from one week to the next. Besides, the food was good, and you got to meet interesting people. The order, such as was left of it, had moved after the fire. After all, their sole purpose in existing had been fulfilled. They went their separate ways. She hadn't gone. She'd rather liked the manor, and, she said, someone ought to stay and see it was properly repaired, because you couldn't trust workmen these days, unless you were on top of them the whole time, in a manner of speaking. This meant breaking her vows, but Mother Superior said this was all right, nothing to worry about. Breaking vows was perfectly okay in a black sisterhood, and it would be all the same in 100 years' time, or rather, 11 years' time. So if it gave her any pleasure, here were the deeds and an address to forward any mail, unless it came in long brown envelopes with windows in the front. Then something very strange had happened to her. Left alone in the rambling building, working from one of the few undamaged rooms, arguing with men with cigarette stubs behind their ears and plaster dust on their trousers, and the kind of pocket calculator that comes up with a different answer if the sums involved are in used notes, she discovered something she never knew existed. She discovered, under layers of silliness and eagerness to please, Mary Hodges. She found it quite easy to interpret builders' estimates and do VAT calculations. She'd got some books from the library and found finance to be both interesting and uncomplicated. She'd stopped reading the kind of women's magazine that talks about romance and knitting and started reading the kind of women's magazine that talks about orgasms. But apart from making a mental note to have one, if ever the occasion presented itself, she dismissed them as only romance and knitting in a new form. So she'd started reading the kind of magazine that talked about mergers. After much thought, she'd bought a small home computer from an amused and condescending young dealer in Norton. After a crowded weekend, she took it back. Not, as he thought when she walked back into the shop, to have a plug put on it, but because it didn't have a 387 co-processor. That bit he understood. He was a dealer, after all, and could understand quite long words. But after that, the conversation rapidly went downhill from his point of view. Mary Hodges produced yet more magazines. Most of them had the term PC somewhere in their title, and many of them had articles and reviews that she had circled carefully in red ink. She read about new women. She hadn't ever realized that she'd been an old woman, but after some thought, she decided that titles like that were all one with the romance and the knitting and the orgasms, and the really important thing was to be yourself, just as hard as you could. She'd always been inclined to dress in black and white. All she needed to do was raise the hemlines, raise the heels, and leave off the wimple. It was while leafing through a magazine one day that she learned that around the country there was an apparently insatiable demand for commodious buildings in spacious grounds run by people who understood the needs of the business community. The following day, she went out and ordered some stationery in the name of the Tadfield Manor Conference and Management Training Centre, reasoning that by the time it had been printed, she'd know all that was necessary to know about running such places. The ads went out the following week. It had turned out to be an overwhelming success, because Mary Hodges realized early in her new career as herself that management training didn't have to mean sitting people down in front of unreliable slide projectors. Firms expected far more than that these days. She provided it. Crowley sank down with his back against a statue. Aziraphale had already toppled backward into a rhododendron bush, a dark stain spreading across his coat. Crowley felt dampness suffusing his own shirt. This was ridiculous. The last thing he needed now was to be killed. It would require all sorts of explanations. They didn't hand out new bodies just like that. They always wanted to know what you'd done with the old one. It was like trying to get a new pen from a particularly bloody-minded stationery department. He looked at his hand in disbelief. Demons have to be able to see in the dark, and he could see that his hand was yellow. He was bleeding yellow. Gingerly, he tasted a finger. Then he crawled over to Aziraphale and checked the angel's shirt. If the stain on it was blood, something had gone very wrong with biology. "Yo, that stung," moaned the fallen angel. "Got me right under the ribs. Yeah, but do you normally bleed blue?" said Crowley. Aziraphale's eyes opened. His right hand patted his chest. He sat up. He went through the same crude forensic self-examination as Crowley.
"Paint?"
he said. Crowley nodded.
"What are they playing at?" said Aziraphale.
"I don't know," said Crowley. "But I think it's called Silly Buggers." His tone suggested that he could play too, and do it better. It was a game. It was tremendous fun. Nigel Tompkins, assistant head purchasing, squirmed through the undergrowth, his mind aflame with some of the more memorable scenes of some of the better Clint Eastwood movies. And to think he'd believed that management training was going to be boring too. There had been a lecture, but it had been about the paint guns and all the things you should never do with them, and Tompkins had looked at the fresh young faces of his rival trainees as, to a man, they resolved to do them all if there was half a chance of getting away with it. If people told you business was a jungle and then put a gun in your hand, then it was pretty obvious to Tompkins that they weren't expecting you to simply aim for the shirt. What it was all about was the corporate head hanging over your fireplace. Anyway, it was rumoured that someone over in United Consolidated had done his promotion prospects a considerable amount of good by the anonymous application of a high-speed earful of paint to an immediate superior, causing the latter to complain of little ringing noises in important meetings, and eventually to be replaced on medical grounds. And there were his fellow trainees, fellow sperms, to switch metaphors, all struggling forward in the knowledge that there could only ever be one chairman of Industrial Holdings, PLC, and that the job would probably go to the biggest prick. Of course, some girl with a clipboard from personnel had told them that the courses they were going on were just to establish leadership potential, group cooperation, initiative, and so on. The trainees had tried to avoid one another's faces. It had worked quite well so far. The whitewater canoeing had taken care of Johnston, punctured eardrum, and the mountain climbing in Wales had done for Whittaker, groin strain. Tompkins thumbed another paint pellet into the gun and muttered business mantras to himself. Do unto others before they do unto you. Kill or be killed. Either shit or get out of the kitchen. Survival of the fittest. Make my day. He crawled a little nearer to the figures by the statue. They didn't seem to have noticed him. When the available cover ran out, he took a deep breath and leapt to his feet,
Okay, douchebags, grab some skin.
Oh, no.
Where one of the figures had been, there was something dreadful. He blacked out. Crowley restored himself to his favourite shape. I hate having to do that, he murmured. I'm always afraid I'll forget how to change back, and it can ruin a good suit.
I think the maggots were a bit over the top, myself, said Aziraphale, but without